Off the ball
on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
Okay, so we're going to turn to the situation at Goodison. We've got Phil McNulty, I'm delighted to say, of BBC Sports Chief Sports Writer. Phil, thanks for joining us. Kilbane put in the call, so you're stuck with us.
Stuck with Kevin, I'd never say that.
So, interesting times at Goodison, not necessarily fun times. What's the very latest you have?
Well, the latest we know today is that it appears that the interest in Sam Allardyce has been reactivated. Obviously, as Kevin will know very well, this has stretched out over 5 weeks now since Ronald Koeman's sacking. And I just think two defeats and the manner of those two defeats in the last few days have really focused minds at Goodison. Obviously, there was a 5-1 loss at home to Atalanta in the Europa League. And of course, yesterday's defeat at Southampton, which was a dreadful performance as well. And I just think Everton have reached a point where they need to make an appointment. The pursuit of Marco Silva reached a dead end. They weren't getting anywhere there, so they need someone in now. And it looks like, at the moment, Sam Allardyce is the leading contender to come in, someone they've had to turn back to, having initially seemed not so keen a few weeks ago.
The initial issue with Allardyce, in so much as we can tell, seems to have been he didn't feel the love enough, frankly.
It sounds like it, yeah. I mean, it sounds like he's spoken to them and they didn't make him an offer quick enough. And I think in the end, I think his quote was, having gone so long without a decision being made, he decided to make a decision himself, and that was to withdraw. It perhaps suggests that Everton didn't really want him that much unless it became an emergency, but circumstances have played into Sam Allardyce's hands in a way, because over the last month or so since they spoke to him, Everton's performances have got progressively worse. There's become more anxiety over their position in the league table. I mean, if you watched them yesterday, that looked like a team that was going down. Obviously, it's early days, but there was nothing there to offer anything in the way of hope. And now, of course, they've had to go back to Sam Allardyce. It's almost played out perfectly for him because, of course, now it's not a question of him trying to persuade them. They are trying to persuade him. So he, in effect, holds all the cards. And in many ways, it sums up the shambles of this whole thing from the day Ronald Koeman was sacked five weeks ago.
Yeah, it's mad to think it's 5 weeks ago now. And is it right that the director of football, Steve Walsh, was initially very keen on Allardyce, but then Farhad Moshiri had other ideas, presumably more expansive ideas in terms of the football he'd like to see his new shiny new club play? Is that we're kind of hearing that from a few different people?
I think so. I think it certainly seems that Steve Walsh was very much pushing Sam Allardyce, even suggesting that he might come with Craig Shakespeare, of course, would have been with Steve Walsh at Leicester. Moshiri's ideas, I think, were rather more exotic. I mean, there was the link with Diego Simeone, which to me sounded completely unrealistic. I think there's probably more chance of Kevin taking over as Everton manager than Diego Simeone. Other people have been mentioned, like Andre Villas-Boas. The one they really tried to push the boat out for was Marco Silva. And obviously, they just hit a brick wall with that. I think Silva wanted to come to Everton, but Watford just put the blocks on it. They, in the end, I think, sent Everton a legal letter telling them to back off. Right. And in the end, that's what Everton had to do. And in the end, performances, the need for a permanent manager, the fact that David Unsworth has not been able to make a success of it as the caretaker, has led them to a position where needs must. And no agreement has been reached yet, we have to say that. But it does seem now that Sam Allardyce is the leading contender. And perhaps now, again, in favour of Sam Allardyce, is that lots of the fans who would have turned their noses up at the idea of Sam Allardyce a month ago might actually look at Everton in recent weeks and think, blimey, we are in massive trouble, we could go down. And maybe now the idea of Sam Allardyce as Everton manager is not quite as unpalatable to them as it was 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think the whole scenery has shifted more in favour of Sam Allardyce now. If they'd been asked how would this play out, it's played out perfectly for him, really, to come in now and almost appear to be like a saviour.
I think that is the big point of it all. It's almost as if, whereas Everton's ambitions laid, Phil, that was a thing. So you look at them at the start of the season, you're looking at Everton trying to break into the top six. Once Koeman's gone, you're looking at a manager, you mentioned there, Simeone, certainly grand ambitions from the club, looking to go to that next level. Now, all of a sudden, it's needs must. That's the thing that's in my head now. And you said even Tony Pulis' name starting to get thrown into the ring and things like this. It's incredible where Everton have gone in such a short space of time. 5 weeks, you say there, Phil. Why has it taken that long? Why has no plan been in place when they've got rid of Ronald Koeman?
I think that's the question lots of people are asking, Kevin. I think most clubs, if they're planning to sack a manager, would at least seem to have something in place, even if not immediately, within a few days or a week or something. I mean, West Ham were heavily criticised for seeing off Slaven Bilic and bringing in David Moyes, but at least, whether you like David Moyes or not, and I think he showed signs of turning them around a little bit last week, at least they made a decision. They had a plan in place. Bilic was out of the door. In comes David Moyes. Whether you agree with the plan or not, at least there was a plan. I don't think Everton had any sort of plan. I think possibly, and I'm not defending them because I think it has been a complete fiasco from first to last, I think they were just stunned by the scale and the speed of the decline under Ronald Koeman. Because as you say, when the season started, Everton fans were thinking top six, maybe not top four, but top six certainly, all this money spent. But unfortunately, it became clear very, very quickly, and you will have seen a lot of them, Kevin, the squad was unbalanced, it had no pace, no width, there was no goal threat. And of course, there was this imbalance of signing three number 10s and Koeman's trying to shoehorn them in. The team looks terrible, it doesn't look a threat, it looks like it's going to concede goals. I think genuinely they were absolutely stunned at the speed and scale of the decline. That is the only excuse that maybe they thought, we've got to get rid of him now after that 5-2 home defeat. But even when you're planning a big decision like that, that has got to be some sort of element of forward planning, and I don't think Everton have had that.
Phil, would it be fair to say that Farhad Bashiri and Bill Kenwright are on a different page at the moment?
Well, the lack of communication from the club makes that very difficult to judge, but it certainly seems that looking from afar, doesn't it? I think, and this is only my personal opinion, I think Bill Kenwright would have loved David Unsworth to make some sort of positive impact in his brief spell as caretaker manager, which might have allowed him to suggest to Farhad Bashiri, look, here's our man, even if it's only to the end of the season. But as we've seen, David Unsworth has struggled to get any sort of response out of the team. In fact, things have arguably deteriorated over the last 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, they won against Watford in freakish circumstances. They were very lucky to get a point at Crystal Palace. They were gifted 2 goals, really. I think Bill would have loved to have somehow found a way to get David Unsworth in there. Well, as I don't believe for 1 second that would have been in Farhad Mashiri's instincts at all to go for the under-23 coach. He wants a big name on the touchline, and he's even had to temper those ambitions now. I mean, Simeone, to me, completely unrealistic. But Marco Silva, I think, would have fitted the bill for them. He's an up-and-coming young manager. He's got a growing reputation. He can clearly get his teams to play good football. I think that was a real blow to them. I think they really thought they were going to get Silva out of Watford. And I think Silva, you would look at his press conferences, he made no attempt in the 2 press conferences at least to distance himself from the Everton job. If anything, he just increased the speculation with his lack of clarity. But Watford stood absolutely firm, were not letting him go. And in the end, Everton have had to turn their attention elsewhere. And in that time when they've had to turn their attention elsewhere, they've had 2 absolutely shocking results and performances. And I think they've gone back to thinking about Sam Allardyce, because I think the alarm bells are really ringing there now. And anyone who has seen that team over the last few weeks, and certainly over the last 4 or 5 days, will understand exactly why those alarm bells are ringing. And who do you call when the alarm bells are ringing? Fireman Sam.
Yeah. It's a real perfect storm when you lay out all those factors. Like, you certainly presume that even if everybody at board level could agree on Silva, that they would have all thought realistically, look, Watford will break here eventually, we'll get our man and he'll want to come, it's a bigger club. So that, you can see that's knocked the wind out of their sails, and Unsworth hasn't been able to buy them any time. We know Kenwright. I mean, he's like the last of the quintessential owners, really, you know, crying down the phone to Alex Ferguson that you're taking my boy when they signed Wayne Rooney. So we're kind of familiar with him, and he didn't have billions to spend, as is now very much the necessity. What do we know about Farhad Mashiri's character, his personality?
We know very little. That is the problem. He never communicates with the club through the club website. He's never done an interview with the official website for the club. He's never done any media interviews, and he's been there, I think it was February last year when he arrived. Before that, because he sacked Roberto Martinez, didn't he? There's been no communication with the fans, really, apart from the very, very small statements, or he issues bulletins through a broadcaster on another radio station, which, again, it's not done through official communiques to the club or to the fans. So we don't really know anything about him at all, other than the initial information that he's obviously come from Arsenal. He's clearly ambitious. He's got money to spend. But what people don't know him, that's the thing. He's a complete mystery as a personality, right, to Everton's fans, and he continues to be so.
Does he go to many games?
Oh, yes, he goes there. I don't think he goes to as many as Bill Kenwright, but he goes to games. He was at the Watford game at home recently, and he's seen quite a lot at Goodison Park. He doesn't go to as many as Bill Kenwright. I'm not sure he was at Southampton. Didn't see him there. But no, he has got an interest. He goes to the games. But as a personality, he remains a complete mystery to everybody, really.
Yeah. Like, we know that the facts and figures are he's got maybe $2.5 billion and lives in Monaco and obviously enjoys this kind of shiny new toy. The fans can't be thrilled, having become maybe accustomed to Everton feeling like a family club and part of the city, and you know, kind of Kenwright was probably a nice a figurehead in some respects, even though they would have liked him to spend more money. But it must be a serious adjustment for Everton fans to suddenly be owned by distant, silent owner.
I think, as Kevin will confirm, Bill Kenwright used to get an awful lot of criticism. In fact, he's getting it still, because he didn't spend enough. He was regarded by some fans as somebody who didn't want to hand over his train set, all this sort of thing. Mashiri has come in, and there's been quite a lot of goodwill towards him because he has shown himself to be a decision maker. He sacked Roberto Martinez and brought Koeman in. The stadium seems to be moving on in a direction it wasn't doing before. And of course, he did provide big funds during the transfer window, albeit, as we now know, spent assembling a squad that was actually worse than the one they had last season, in many respects, because the key decision, yes, they spent the money and they bought plenty of players in, but they never replaced Romelu Lukaku. Strategically, that was an error. That's not Farhad Mashiri's fault. I suspect you have to lay that at the door of Steve Walsh and Ronald Koeman. But he has had a fund of goodwill because he's shown ambition, he's moved things along, been prepared to spend money. But now, I think for the first time, questions are really being asked about him, because for somebody who, you know, big businessman, big hitter, to do what he's done and still be searching for a new manager 5 weeks after sacking the last one. And even fans who were saying, well, don't worry about that, it's just we're taking our time, we, you know, we're being measured, you know, we're just going to find the right man. I think it's dawned on them over the last week or so that it's not Everton being measured, it's Everton not actually realising what their target was once the Silver Avenue is closed off to them. So I think he is regarded well by most of the fans, but suddenly lots of serious questions are being asked about him because of the way that this managerial search has been conducted.
Yeah, Martin O'Neill's name came up at the weekend, Phil. He all of a sudden he went odds on favourite at the weekend. What truth is there in that that you know of, and how have they actually conducted any sort of interviews with any manager, even Sean Dyche as well? There was talk of him early on as well, but particularly Martin O'Neill. There's huge interest in of course over here with him. So what can you confirm or deny anything with Martin O'Neill?
I think people checked that out and were told that there was nothing in that one. I mean, I think what's been interesting with the advent of social media, you see the bookies odds every 5 minutes, don't you? And right throughout this, there have been lots of people who have suddenly been odds on for the Everton job. First of all, it was Sean Dyche, then it was Silver, then it was Martin O'Neill, in fact, as you mentioned.
O'Neill last night, even at the end of the match of the day too, Kev, you were obviously on, they flashed up the odds and... I'd had a busy day and I suddenly thought, well, when did Martin O'Neill become 11 to 10 on favourite?
Yeah.
This all started doing the rounds on Friday, I think, about Martin O'Neill. He suddenly came into the betting. People were asking, had he signed this new contract with the Republic of Ireland, and would he be hurt by what had happened over the criticism he'd received for losing the playoff to Denmark? But the people who checked that out said there wasn't any serious interest there. And of course, suddenly, I think after yesterday, they've watched that game and thought, we need to do something now. And Sam Allardyce, who they sort of spoke to and then just thanked him for the chat a few weeks ago, suddenly is now the leading contender again. And I think that shows how quickly the decline has been. And now I think, as I said, the alarm bells, because of the performances and the results, are really ringing there now. And I think they feel in many ways Sam Allardyce might be the least worst option, if you like, now. And I do think the cards have moved in his favour now. They're asking him rather than the other way around. And supporters who poo-pooed the idea of Sam Allardyce, or we don't want him, he's a dinosaur, whether people think that's right or wrong, that was a view of lots of the fans. Suddenly they're thinking now, actually, where Everton are in such a bad state that might not actually be such a bad thing to have Sam Allardyce there, because he does have a proven track record of sorting teams out. But having watched Everton and the players they've got and the defence they've got, I think he's got an awful lot of work there, because I don't know the players are there to play in the style that Sam Allardyce likes to play. I think Mashiri will have to have some very deep pockets in January if Allardyce gets this job to bring in the sort of players he wants to play the sort of survival football that suddenly Everton are having to play or will have to play. And I think Kevin will agree this was completely unthinkable in August, because everyone was looking up. So, and even who was the only team to get a point off Manchester City in the league this season? It's Everton. So the first couple of games, they started quite well and that optimism rose a bit. But then suddenly there were a couple of real reality checks. They were very well beaten by Chelsea, by Spurs at home, by Manchester United away. They really suddenly looked a very ordinary side. And a decline started, which sadly for David Unsworth, he's shown no sign of arresting. And I think that's led Everton to the point now when they really need to do something. The other name that was doing the rounds, I'm not sure whether I mentioned him before, was Andre Villas-Boas. He suddenly appeared as a potential contender. But it seems to me now that although there's no deal agreed with Sam Allardyce and certainly nothing coming out of Everton, he seems to now be the leading contender. And I think it's almost like an emergency appointment. What will be interesting is the length of contract they give him. Will they try and give him 18 months? Will he accept 18 months? Or will he say, no, I want 3 years? It's going to be interesting there. I'll be really interested in the length of contract that he signs, if he signs one.
Just one other name that was mentioned. You mentioned there's Sean Dyche as well. Given what Everton have done, their appointments, what Bill Kenwright in appointing, if I'm thinking like David Moyes, Roberto Martinez, that have had lower league experience, got promotions and things like this, Sean Dyche would certainly fit a Bill Kenwright type appointment. Why has it gone very cold on Sean Dyche? Because it looked to me like he could be the man that could actually do something in there.
I think that's a mystery to everyone, Kevin, particularly given Burnley's results. I think they were unlucky to lose yesterday. He organises teams superbly. There's always this doubt about, would he do it at a different club? But how would anyone know until they give him the chance? And I don't know, it's only a hunch. I think that if Bill Kenwright couldn't have got David Unsworth into position, even if it's only to the end of the season, I think he might have liked Sean Dyche. But it seems to me clearly that Mashiri is calling the shots. He went away from Allardyce initially. I think he was one of his initial ideas when it was maybe they were struggling to get a top target. He eyed up these other people. They haven't come, like Silva. And so suddenly he's now gone back to Sam Allardyce. But as I say, even Andre Villas-Boas was getting a mention over the weekend. As I say, nothing's been signed or sealed yet. And what we've come to learn from these last few weeks at Everton is that you only believe it when you
expect
see it.
Expect the unexpected, is that what it is?
Well, yeah, that's for years, Kevin, as you well know. Particularly when you were playing, that's it. Expect the unexpected. But at the moment, it does look like Sam Allardyce is the leading contender. And suddenly the bricks, if you like, have fallen into place for him. So it'll be interesting to see whether they can confirm something on that.
Well, I was reading Allardyce is on holiday in...
When you see him holding up the scarf, will you think, oh yes, there's the new Everton manager.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I was reading he's on holiday in Dubai. He was at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix over the weekend. So I can almost just picture Big Sam sitting back with a cool drink by his side and grinning to himself as each goal went in against Southampton. And he's probably adding on a zero per goal to his contract.
I'm sure he would never think like that.
No, never. No. So there we go. And Kevin Coleman definitely has been mentioned now because he's been taking a lot of high-powered phone calls around the office here.
Who was that, sorry?
Kevin Coleman.
Well, I don't know why he hasn't been mentioned before.
Well, you just dismissed that out of hand anyway, Phil. Now it's gone. That's it.
I've heard lots of Everton fans mention Kevin Coleman, but not necessarily as the manager. Let's just say they've heard them mentioning him. But no, I have to say Kevin Coleman, if I can promote a piece on our own website, did a great piece on Everton today, in conversation with my colleague Chris Bevan, and I think. If you read all of that, there are some really salient points made about what has happened over this managerial search. It has been a shambles. There's no getting away from that. There's no way when Monday, 5 weeks ago to this day, when Ronald Koeman was sacked, anyone would have thought 5 weeks later we'd still be sitting here speculating and wondering who would come in.
Yeah.
I think it's been very badly mishandled. There's no getting away from that. And that's why I do think for the first time now, maybe Mashiri does have some bridges to build with the fans. I think you painted Bill Kenwright before as this sort of popular man of the people type of thing. I mean, he has had a lot of criticism from Everton fans in the past and is continuing to get it now, where people are saying, why is he still involved? All this sort of thing. But I think Bill does, he loves the club so much, he maybe just doesn't want to tear himself away and he wants to be, if you like, the Evertonian conscience of the club, whereas maybe Mashiri is perhaps a little bit more ruthless in his approach. But it has been a mess. There's no getting away from that. And once they've actually sorted it out, then they need to get themselves around to the even bigger business, if you like, of getting that team playing in a manner that will give Evertonians some hope, not just of improvement, but of survival. Because I do think you've noticed the tone over the last day or two has really changed, that the Everton fans, it's suddenly dawning on them just how poorly that team is performing, how badly it is set up, how poorly it's balanced. There's not much, apart from the goalkeeper, I don't think, there's not much good you can actually say about what Everton have done over the last few weeks.
Phil, super stuff. Thanks for all that.
Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to do anything I can
well,
to play
it then.
My country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
So, busy football show. We'll talk to Andy West, who's in Barcelona. We'll be joined by Pat Nevin very shortly. Kevin Coleman is here. Hello.
Hi, Joe.
Money, Kevin. If there's one thing you're obsessed with, if there's one headline that you'll always pick on...
Well, I knew you'd be all over this one. And the thing
money.
Is... Yeah, you'd be all over
filthy
it.
Filthy money.
Now, I just need to try and find it because the one I just got up then was from last year. But the thing is, it's been released today, the wages from all European sides today. And as I was saying, you're the one that actually loves all this carry-on, Joe. And if I can find it somewhere on the line, it was on the the Mail app earlier on. Anyway, to cut a long story short, was Barcelona were the top paying club in for average wise in Europe. Have you got it there? Good man. You can tell me then, Joe. You can refresh me. I'm trying to find it there on Twitter earlier on.
You had one job.
Yeah.
So Barcelona, with their new deal for Lionel Messi, which keeps them at the club until 2021, they've overtaken Manchester United as the top spenders when it comes to salaries. So they have jumped. Manchester United are 5.24 million. Mm. You've then got City on 5.23 million, which is, by the way, an average of 100 grand a week per, per player.
Well, Joe, just to say, to cut across you here as well, now, the average wage in the Premier League is now 50 grand a week.
That was the interesting one. So Barcelona are top because they're given Messi close to 600,000 a week basic.
Yes.
And Lord knows what else. Yep. But they're giving Messi that basic. So basically it goes Barcelona number one with 6.6 million. This is sterling. Mm. And then it's Manchester United. And then it's City and Real Madrid are there as well. But yeah, as you rightly say, the very interesting thing is that for the first time in football history, and it's not the case in any of the other leagues, clearly, where it's so dominated by Barcelona and Real Madrid and Bayern Munich and the really top clubs. For the first time, the English Premier League's average spending wages is now 50,000 per week. No other football league close to
It's incredible. And you're looking across the board and you're looking down at the Burnleys and you're looking down at the Southamptons, who's, you know, Southampton and Everton, average wage of, you know, around two and a half million a year. And it's just unbelievable. West Ham's another one as well. You know, and you're looking at getting value for money out of Everton and West Ham at the moment. It is unbelievable the way that it's gone. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible stuff, really.
But are they happy, Pat Nevin?
Not as happy as me. You're beginning to like that tune.
Yeah. I went for a run the other day. I won't lie, that one was thrown in.
It was. It just gets you going. The other thing is I'm extremely happy and I'm in no way bitter. and a lot of guys of my age are quite bitter, particularly as I left the top level of English football the year the Premier League started. Good timing there, I think. but in actual fact, you know, it's just, it's a business and it's always got more and more money in it. It would appear that it's going to keep on going for quite some time. I always remember being told by Gordon Taylor, you know, never be too negative about it. Remember, you get paid more than Sir Stanley Matthews or Jimmy Johnston or, you know, some great players in the past. And you think, yeah, fair enough. It's just the business. You're lucky if your time's right, you know.
I can understand the bitterness, though, if of former footballers who might be, and they're looking on at players they might perceive to be lesser than them, and they're set for life, and
more perceived to be they are.
Yeah, yeah, probably.
And it depends how they handle the finances. That's the thing.
Well, I know, a lot of it, aren't we? But you can imagine being a former pro. You know, you obviously left education early to go and play. You played at a top level for a big club, and you're now. You know, you'd be skimming around maybe on the after-dinner circuit and you just kind of might think to yourself, God, it would be lovely. It would be lovely to not have to worry about any of this. I can understand that bitterness.
But for all that, and Pat will know this as well with some of the levels that he's worked at as well, certainly from maybe a board level as well, that is not the case throughout football. So we're looking at it at the extreme elite here, aren't we? That's the thing. And it kind of puts everything else into perspective when you look at the rest of the leagues. Yeah, even over here, League of Ireland, all the different standards of football that we look at, they'll never ever get to anywhere near that level, and that's the difference. If you reach that elite level, you have one season there or two seasons, you have made it in many respects. Yeah,
yeah, you're in good shape. So the weekend's football, Pat, you were covering a game for us yesterday alongside Dave McIntyre. Have a listen.
It's been a brilliant game, fascinating, and that Huddersfield 10 are just trying they might just to keep Man City out. The free scoring Manchester City, over 40 goals already in this Premier League campaign. De Bruyne plays a 1-2 and Sterling goes through to Jesus. Oh, that's gone in off Sterling, and Manchester City do lead. Well, in the end, when they needed the second goal, it was a huge stroke of good fortune after all the brilliant football they played. 84 minutes played, Huddersfield 1, City 2.
They're devastated. The fans, the players, they put so much in there. They've made a couple of changes, but maybe that changed more than anything else. Sterling deciding to come inside. He needed to come inside during this game. He's had a massive effect in this game. But boy, has he got lucky there. He's come inside, the ball's been cleared, but it's come up maybe off his thigh as he's just chasing it in off the goalkeeper. And it is just off the top of his right thigh. and then probably almost certainly winning in Manchester City, although you don't see anything in this game certain. But what a difference it's made, that little tactical change, him going inside, he's got a penalty and he's now got a goal.
Yeah, so a 2-1 win in the end for Man City. Their 8-point gap remains intact. So, Pat, you might talk to us more about that tactical change we heard you reference there, and I presume Man City deserved the win.
Yeah, they deserved the win. I mean, the vast percentage of the, you know, the play and the possession, as they always do, they were a good distance, behind what they usually are. I think Pep Guardiola had a couple of points about the fact that, you know, it's going to get harder. It's winter time. There's more games. They'll pick up one or two injuries. A couple of players didn't look up for it. Kevin De Bruyne was pretty damn average, to be fair. I know it's a real shocker to say it, but, you know, he had a quiet game. A lot of misplaced passes, a lot more than usual. A couple of theories. Number one theory, I've said for a while that when they lose John Stones, I don't think they'll look as good. I don't think they have looked as good since they lost John Stones now. But one or two have kind of stood up to the plate, you know, and they've looked a little bit better. But it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a battle. And I think he knows, you know, Pep knows that that's going to happen. The reason why I was going on about that, going in for the right, that was my lead into halftime. I said, look, Sterling, get off that line there. You know, allow your right fullback to get beyond you. Ask them some different questions. Yeah, you're getting beyond them on the right-hand side. That's fine. But if you go in there, it's another question because you've got you sorted at the moment. They understand where everyone has to be. So you don't often get it wrong. So I thought I'd mention it once or twice.
Do you know, Pat, as well, you mentioned there De Bruyne. De Bruyne, if you can say he's gone off the ball, perhaps maybe in the last couple of games. But now it's the other one that steps up, David Silva. He started to take control of games more. It's almost if one or the other, De Bruyne or Silva, recognised when maybe one or the other is failing a little bit. It's a great and amazing thing to see. That's unbelievable that Pep Guardiola's got those two playing like that.
It's not just them. I mean, it's back to my original argument. The concept is the only player I thought you could really struggle to do without Stones, because even how good De Bruyne is, even how good he is, it's okay. Silva can do it. Even how good Sané is, it's okay. Someone else, Sterling, will come in and do it. Or, you know, Bernardo Silva will come in and do it. Even how good Aguero is, don't worry. Jesus will come in and do it. And the only area, I got a bit of stick for it. A lot of people were having a dig at me for it when I said it. But people say how wonderful De Bruyne is. And he is. He's brilliant. But I think Silva's as good. And I've always felt, you know, like he is a world-class player. So you're right. It's not lucky that it's there. They've put it there in place. Pep knows. He understands not every brilliant player is going to stay brilliant all the time or fit all the time. So you better not be reliant on them. I don't think they are reliant on anyone totally. But as they say, I mean, also the other one, watching the goalkeeper quite closely yesterday, I have to say I was hugely impressed with him. I thought he was absolutely brilliant. Every time, you know, it's what, you know what it's like? You see a goalkeeper come out and you think, oh my God, here you got a problem here. Mm. And then you watch him coming out and you think, you know what? You've got about five different ideas in your mind and you can do them all. He was absolutely brilliant on the ball.
And is there anyone in particular trying to step into the John Stones playmaking role?
Otamendi has actually looked good. I think he's looked much better than I expected him to be this season. I think he's really, really improved. And, you know, I have to say, I was quite surprised that the more time I've spent watching him, the more I've been actually impressed with him. I think I have to kind of accept that I got that slightly wrong, that I didn't realise how good he can be. His percentages, when you look at his percentages on the ball. Now, he scored an own goal in the game. It wasn't really his fault. There's nothing much he could do about it. But stepping forward from the back, he wasn't Stones, but he was pretty damn close to it. A lot closer than I thought it would be. And this is a player who's improved. And it's back to that point about Pep. Always improving players. And he improves a player like Otamendi, but he's also improving great players, making them extremely good players. And actually, I heard a wee whisper. I don't know if it's absolutely true, but the player that you'd really like more than anyone else, and now that I've watched it and it's taken me a wee while, I thought, yep, got it. He'd love Andreas Christensen from Chelsea. I think that's the one he'd really like. He's not going to get him, but he's the one that seems at that sort of age it's going to be able to do the same sort of thing as Stones.
Right, okay. So one point, Kev, before we leave Huddersfield Man City. So, I mean, look, these are the games City... It's going to happen for them where they concede a goal. Maybe it's against the run of play, maybe it's not. And they have to dig in, and it's a well-organised side. And the neutral who wants the title race is hoping they don't quite get it done and drop points, and they haven't here, and we saw the celebrations when they scored the second goal and everybody's in and happy. So just one point though, Sterling has 12 goals this season now, 8 in the Premier League, so only Kane and Salah are ahead of him. It's a really turning into a monumental season in the career of Raheem Sterling. You did a really interesting piece on Match of the Day last night where you just showed his movement off the ball.
It was hardly interesting, Joel. You know, it might have been interesting to you, I don't know, but it was only because that tweet that surfaced last week, and you start to then realise exactly
with Guardiola showing
what Pep Guardiola is doing on the training ground.
I presume you saw that, Pat, did you?
I have not quite seen it yet.
All right,
No, it's funny enough, we're both going on about Sterling.
Yeah.
It's really weird that, because I'm going on during the game saying that, look, technically, you need to change something. And whether it's Sterling, I don't know what you said last night, but whether it's Sterling or whether it's Pep saying it to him, I have a suspicion it's partially Pep.
I think the tweet that came up last week, Pat, it was in relation to Raheem Sterling's body shape, what he does when he's laying off the ball. And it's showing he's been manhandled, really, by Pep Guardiola, trying to coerce him into different positions, trying to tell him which runs to make. As soon as you lay the ball off spin, turn, always on the move, all this sort of thing, really, which, again, it's just that hands-on approach, really. And what I was just trying to illustrate last night was about, yes, he's a very good dribbler with the ball, but we're seeing the other side of it now. We're seeing them little short movements where he's actually, little pop-off and go, spinning in behind defenders without even touching the ball. And we saw it for the penalty. He just made the run. He recognised that David Silva's got the ability to make those sort of passes. And he sets off and he goes. He's sucking defenders underneath the ball. He's running in behind them and all these sort of things. It was interesting to see, particularly with that tweet that actually surfaced, the length that Guardiola's going to try to get him make him a better player.
Yeah, there was one particular one in the first half, I'm sure you remember it, I'm sure you used it, what he did, he just nipped it short and then spun, and he must have made 10 yards on the defender. He just absolutely left him for dead. And actually, in fact, they took off the left back in the end. He was suffering that much. But because you've got a number of different things he can do, he can use pure pace, he's got a bit of skill as well. He's doing those little technical things like give and goes and move, and then add on top of that, hey, by the way, go inside. Just go inside. You'll frighten the life out of people, and you'll create space outside you, so that they don't know what to do with
it. It's very tricky. Like if you're Sterling, are you happier for the defender to come out with you as you're moving closer towards a player with the ball? Or do you want him to come with you, or do you want to let him to have the ball and turn and run?
Depends on the type of player you are. I mean, we're very different players, Kevin and I, although played similar areas sometimes. Just give me the ball. Don't care. Don't even put it in front. Certainly don't put it in front of me.
Right.
I mean, I can run, but I don't want to be doing that. Just give me the ball, and I'll do that guy in front of me. That's all I ever wanted. But if you had two people on you, you had to rethink and redevelop how to find space. And to be honest, the one Kevin's talking about it is the first thing you taught, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go short to go long. That is the first thing you taught. It's amazing how many people forget it.
Yeah.
Or can't do it particularly well.
Just a last point, I suppose, on that.
Yeah, because I want to get to Liverpool, Chelsea.
It was more. It's just the fact is that when players are signed by big clubs, they're almost considered the finished article. He's 20 years of age. He signed to Man City. There's a lot of expectation on him, and he needs to be coached. He's still developing. He's still learning, and this is where a player can actually go. One way or another, can they develop? Can they learn? Sometimes, and most of the times, I would think 9 times out of 10 over the last 20, 30 years, it would be down to the player and how he develops himself and how he learns. But Guardiola's a different concept. He is actually with those players individually, getting the best out of them, every one of those players.
Well, interestingly, I'm not sure, based on the body language alone, how keen Raheem Sterling was to have Pep Guardiola in his face.
I'm with you.
And I think Pep Guardiola walked away from that conversation thinking, you little shit. He kept almost turning away from Guardiola. Yeah. It was over the summertime in training. And I think Guardiola gave him no choice. Like, he grabbed him in his face several times. Sterling sort of half walks away. Guardiola follows him. I'm sure he's keen to learn and everything, but I guess Pep is pretty intense. Liverpool 1, Chelsea 1. Salah with his 10th goal in 13 Premier League appearances. He's broken Robbie Fowler's record in terms of a best start to a Liverpool career. And then Willian, as he said himself, with his very deliberate goal. It was beautiful, he said to the Match of the Day interviewer at the end. So 1-1 here, Pat, between Liverpool and Chelsea.
Yeah, and I'd been over in Seville for the game in Seville, which was extraordinary. Watching Liverpool being pretty good, you know, not great, but pretty good in the first half. And by the way, Sevilla, as we have to call them, were awful in the second half. We know what happened there. But the reason why I mention it is because Salah was pretty poor in that game. It was really weird. He had to go and he had to do a lot of work defensively, particularly in the second half. And I was sitting there thinking, has it gone then? You know, have we had that explosive little period at the start of the season? And then he plays against Chelsea like that. And you think, nah, it's still there. And I think the word explosive is the big part of it with him. That pace, that little bit of power that he's got, that kind of pocket battleship kind of, it's hard to stop when he's on the go and when he's confident like that and when he's got that, you know, utter fitness. And then you looked and you compared him and Hazard together and you thought, God, I could sit and watch this all day long, watching them two doing that sort of thing. But will it keep on going with Salah? Don't know, it's going to be harder and harder as time goes on because he's beginning to shoulder too much of it for me. You know, not getting the best out of Coutinho all the time. Certainly not getting the best out of Firmino all the time. Both of them great players, as we know. But they're asking a hell of a lot of him just now. But maybe he's one of those players, and there's a lot of them around, that they actually flourish. They say, right, okay, you're the main man. We'll give you the ball all the time. And then suddenly they flourish. So he's a joy to watch. He's been absolutely brilliant.
Clearly, Kev, Klopp is kind of aware of this because we saw it was Salah, Sturridge, Oxlade-Chamberlain. So Mane's on the bench, Firmino's on the bench.
Yeah.
It's a strange decision on the face of it. So clearly Klopp, I mean, maybe one of them had an injury or there was tiredness or whatever.
No, I saw Mane over in Sevilla. Don't worry. I know why he was left out. He wasn't interested.
Really?
Oh no, he was awful. It was really strange to see it.
He's made a brilliant. He's played brilliantly for them at times.
Yeah, I'm not saying he's a bad player.
Still a big call though, Pat, isn't he?
Yeah, it's a big call, but he just looked. Yeah, and you know, it's like the managers look at them training sometimes and see a game and think, right, yeah, he's gone off the boil. Maybe he's, as you say, carrying a bit of injury. But his body language, it really wasn't particularly good in the second half, and particularly over in Sevilla.
Not closing down then, presumably not pressing the way Klopp might want.
It just completely disappeared out of the game, as did Coutinho, it has to be said. Now, it seems awfully negative in Liverpool, who played very well for the first half of that game on Sevilla and played very well in parts of the game against Chelsea as well. But, you know, Salah, no, he's first in the sheet, definitely first in the sheet.
It's interesting you mentioned Coutinho there, because Robbie Fowler did a piece today, said that he is no way, in any way, shape or form, anywhere near some of the world's elite players, Coutinho, almost suggesting that Liverpool should have accepted the bid that they got in the summer for him. You know, when you're seeing the players that are around world football and you're seeing that money that's gone in there for Coutinho, in hindsight, is that looking like the greatest of deal that Liverpool did in not letting him go?
Yeah, but had they sold him to Barcelona and he's playing in the current Barcelona team and creating and scoring, you'd say, what a terrible mistake. You've let that for now. Because he wouldn't he, in the Barcelona team? Because it would suit him absolutely down to the ground. And he'd be completely motivated because, obviously, he clearly wanted to go at the time as well. It may look, and you only know that, I think, in longer term. I think in short term, that's a tough one to call. Because we all know that there's every chance that he could end up at Barcelona in January or more specifically next summer.
I was looking, by the way, both Liverpool and Chelsea have a really nice run into Christmas now. Like Liverpool, they're away to Stoke. They're away to Stoke, they've Brighton, they've Everton, they've West Brom, they've Bournemouth, right up until December 22nd when they have Arsenal. So like there's a real chance to put wins together there. And Chelsea have Swansea at home, they've Newcastle at home, they've West Ham, they've Huddersfield, they've Southampton, they've Bournemouth, they've Brighton, and then they've Stoke, and that takes them all the way up to December 30th. So they're probably glancing at their calendars, both managers, saying, I wonder, can we put a run here on City at all?
Now, Chelsea were thinking of that beforehand. The talk down the bridge has been that for some time. The Liverpool game was the one. Get to the Liverpool game, get beyond that, and still be in touch. That was the whole idea. And they are, I think, in touch with, say, United, slightly less so with City. I mean, had City not managed to get that win, and then you consider that they've got, you know, United away and at home, still, you know, it's not beyond the possibilities that they could get caught. They just need a little bit of a dip. But it's all hope, it's all ifs, it's all buts, you know, it absolutely is the case. But that's it's great sometimes if you're in a position where you're playing well. I think Chelsea are playing the last three or four games since that Manchester United game particularly, but they've actually beginning to play really well, looking confident again. And they're a team that looks as if they could go in a run of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 games in a row. And that's, if you're leading the pack like Manchester City, now you've got to start looking behind you a little bit. And I think United and City will start looking a little bit behind them at Chelsea now, because they are on that run.
Pat, yeah. Can I ask you one thing about Willian? What's been the story there? Why has Conte not necessarily used him a lot over his reign there?
3-5-2 and 4-3-3. That's it. No more than
but
that.
But he can play in that system, though. He can play in one of the three. I know he's used Pedro a lot last season, but yeah. Willian, you
well,
think...
Pedro get... was, well, Pedro was a lot of Field's player of the year last season down at Chelsea. His scoring was phenomenal. His pace was amazing as well. I don't think he's got anything against Willian. I think when he plays a different system, you know, he will play Willian some of the time. I think he's playing brilliantly just now. He had a quiet time at the start, and he had a couple of little chances at the start of the season, and he kind of looked a little bit disinterested, but he's got it back now, and he's flying now. If he was playing a different system, Willian would be playing. And if you look at the way that they are playing just now, some of the time, which is the 3-5-2, there's no Pedro and there's no Willian. And both of them have been absolutely brilliant for the last parts of this season. And I often was trying to explain it to some Chelsea fans who were getting a bit miffed about it, the ones who like Willian and Pedro. And sometimes you can be in the best form of your life. I spent, you know, years and years in the Scotland squad, and I ended up getting 28 caps. And I would expect that I've got a lot more. But we played 3-5-2 for years. My only chance at game was at centre forward. You know, and, you know, I could play it, you know, but there's a lot of other guys that were pretty damn good around at the time in centre forward. We had a good cast of centre forwards. And yeah, there's nothing wrong with your play, nothing wrong with your doing, but you're not going to be one of the two wide midfielders, because they're going to be guys like yourself, Kev, that can hammer up and down that line, you know, can do really good defensive work as well as the attacking work as well. So I think Willian, more than anyone else, he's suffered from 3-4-3.
Yeah, so is it with the potential for him to go?
Yeah, wait a minute. This is the team that sold De Bruyne and Salah. And come on, of course there's a chance to go. Yeah. You look at that position, it's the graveyard for so many players. Over
wingers quite often as well, in particular.
But it's the right wing for Chelsea. I mean, it's the right wing. It's Schürrle, it's Salah, it's, you know, it's De Bruyne who was stuck out there for periods of time as well. It's Cuadrado. It's a whole bunch of them. There's millions of them. They've all had really good careers, you know, going on. They stuck Sturridge out there for a period in time as well. Yeah. It is the graveyard position, and it may well be Willian's downfall. I don't think so, actually. Listen to him talk. I think he's bought into the idea that I'll get games now and again.
Yeah. So before you go then, Pat, I don't know, did you see the Man United win over Brighton in full? Kevin, I know you caught the second half. So, I mean, United are certainly in that holding pattern of just trying to hang on until Man City maybe wobble. So, I mean, the most interesting aspect here is, based on what you saw, and Kev, you did say Brighton were very organised, so that is a factor here. But is there any reason, really, why in the short to medium term, Lukaku with Zlatan behind him, with Martial on one wing, with Rashford on another wing, with Pogba roaming around doing what he likes, is there any reason why that quintet should not be electric and destroy 95% of teams they play against?
I don't know that to me. I personally don't think he would do that. I think he's still got to have that defensive responsibility, even if he's playing as a number 10 in Man United side. So Ibrahimovic then getting back behind the ball, having to think about that sort of... I don't necessarily see him starting in that position. He may start him against one of the lesser teams in the Premier League, but I couldn't see him playing like that. Given what he's done when he's been at Chelsea and his spells and wherever he's been around Europe... He has got the best out of players from dropping to. I don't necessarily see Ibrahimovic being that so-called midfield player. I can't see it now.
When he comes off the bench, will they catch fire? Did it look good to you, especially?
Not particularly. No. Right. And that was the contrasting stat between City going to Huddersfield and United at home to Brighton. Both Brighton and Huddersfield played very, very similar. Dropped off, defended very, very deep, making a back six at times, difficult to break down. But City was still finding ways to get behind it. I didn't see it necessarily from United at the weekend, no. And that's that would be the worry, I think, when you're going to come up against a side like that.
Do you not think they're going to have enough power anyway to get most of these ones? And they've got Jose's nous to get by most of these teams. And I keep on saying most of these teams, because it's one game, they've got tough games coming up. They've got Arsenal, is it, next week? But the United City game on the 10th. And that's going to be, there's a good argument, that's the most interesting game of the season so far. We know how Manchester City are going to play. It doesn't matter that it's at Old Trafford. But Man United, what team are they going to put out? You know that Pogba's going to be there. You know Fellaini probably going to get a game as well. They're going to have the land of the giants out there. And they're just going to shell it. They're absolutely going to shell it. And do you know what? Man United fans might be shouting and bawling the radio. See if it works. Well done, Josie. And do you know what? It might.
Nick a 1-0.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't watched, been at Huddersfield there. Huddersfield have one play. The basic play was to get the ball to the platter and as often as you can. Hi, by the way, he's a better player than I thought he was.
I was real impressed with him as well, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And good holding play as well. And you know that everybody knows that if there's a weakness at Manchester City, it's going to be through the middle there. And Kompany, again, looked a, you know, not 100%. He's never going to be 100% again, but, you know, you're going to stick it in there. You're going to try and put as much pressure in that area as possible. And Jose Mourinho is not stupid. If he's anything, he's not stupid. And you've got to know that he's going to put the ball up there at Pogba. He's going to get it to Lukaku. And if there's a weakness, as I say, in that team, the problem is they need to get the ball first.
Yeah.
The one thing they've got more than any other team is, it's okay. You only need the ball anywhere roughly from your own 18-yard onwards, and then you can lump it. I can't wait for that game. I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but I'm really looking forward to that game. Rather disappointingly, I think, Kev, you're going to be there, aren't you? I'm at the Merseyside derby. I'm having to put the Merseyside derby. I'll deal with that.
Yeah, that should be a good day, though. Liverpool Everton 2:15 and then Manchester derby at 4:30, yeah, Sunday the 10th. We have those games live.
Hibs Celtic for Pat as well.
I'm sorry, my Hibs fans will shout at me, but I'm going to the Liverpool Everton game. Definitely, that's the one I'll be up for. For ourselves and News Talk.
Well, Big Sam will be there and he'll nick a 1-0 and that'll be that. Listen, that's great stuff. Thanks a million.
Brilliant, Pat.
Pleasure. See you guys.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Watch 35 live European Rugby Champions Cup games this season on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome, Max. So we're talking to events in Spain. It was an interesting weekend. Barcelona against Valencia in a top-of-the-table clash finished 1-1. Barcelona had a perfectly good goal disallowed. It was Roy Carroll-esque, really. Manchester United against Spurs kind of situation. That was Lionel Messi, who was not happy. But they did hit back in the end, Barcelona, to earn a 1-1 draw in the end at second place, Valencia, in the Mestalla. We've got Andy West, BBC, who's in Barcelona, on the line. So 1-1, I presume lots of talk about, well, video technology, the Premier League has it, why don't we have it over here today?
Yeah, and I think it's pretty much unanimous throughout Spain that it needs to be introduced. The only person who's opposed to it is the only one who matters. Javier Tebas, the president of La Liga, is constantly trying to prevent this from coming in, and he puts it down to money, which is so shabby when La Liga obviously is one of the richest leagues in the world. He has finally relented and said they will introduce a video referee system, but obviously that's not goal line technology, which he says is too expensive.
Right. So a 1-1 draw means Barcelona remain 4 points clear of Valencia at the top of the table. I suppose the big news emanating from Barcelona over the last few days is that Messi has literally signed his new contract. He's there until 2021. It's worth a whole heap of money, naturally. There were certainly murmurings over the last week or two that Messi was approaching the point where he could negotiate with other clubs, and people were getting worried and wondering, as well, is Messi looking around at this team, which is aging, and certainly it doesn't seem like headed necessarily for an absolutely golden era. And people were starting to worry. But he has decided to sign, literally, and he's staying, and everybody's very delighted and happy with that, I presume.
Absolutely, yes, of course. There was increasing talk, because they announced that he'd agreed the contract 6 months ago, nearly, during the summer, but then he hadn't signed it. And the club came out with various feeble excuses about, we haven't had time, which, you know, how long do you need? Half an hour to sign a piece of paper and take a few photos? And there was a lot of talk about Manchester City, obviously, with the Pep Guardiola link, PSG as well with the money, but it was more City, to be honest. And, you know, imagine Messi going on a free transfer. So it was an increasing story. The club insisted throughout, and they really did, no, there's no problem. It's just sorting things out. So now, finally he has signed. We'll probably never really know if he was string them along, if he was really thinking about leaving, but the main thing is now that he's staying, and he showed his value with an incredible pass to Jordi Alba for the equaliser yesterday. And really, after Iniesta faded and had to be substituted, Messi was the only one with any creativity in that team, and they depend on him so much at the moment.
Yeah, but Iniesta was actually very good in the first half, wasn't he? You say he fared badly, and Messi did stand up. But the one thing, Andy, it's more, they're unbeaten now this season, Barcelona, but there are those murmurings still around the club that it isn't quite right. Where is that coming from, given the form that they're in?
I think it's everyone sees the reliance on Messi. The over-reliance on him. If he got injured, you really think they'd be lost, because there is no creativity in that team. The way they play is predictable, really. Yeah. Obviously, it doesn't help that Luis Suarez is out of form. And I think that it was interesting, actually, before the game, you may have seen quotes from Messi saying, Neymar leaving has made us more balanced, but we've lost a lot of offensive firepower. And he's right on both counts. And we saw that absolutely yesterday in Valencia, especially in the first half. Barcelona were excellent in their control of the game, their pressing. Valencia couldn't get a kick. And whenever they did get the ball, Barca won it back straight away. They really played well without the ball in that respect, with the ball until it got to the final third. And then they, despite all that possession, all that dominance, they didn't really create any clear chances. The goal was, you know, a half chance and a terrible error by the goalkeeper, the one that wasn't given. And they just weren't creating chances, and they didn't look like creating chances. But the big thing for them is Dembélé. They spent 150 million on him. He barely played through injury. He'll be back in a few weeks, and he needs to really give them what they want him to, because he's got the pace, the penetration that they're lacking.
Suarez has scored just 5 goals in 17 games, so considering, as you said, they've lost Neymar, it's a bad time for Suarez to lose form. 5 goals in 17 games, and just doesn't, to the eye, look as nearly as explosive or as sharp as he once was for the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. What's been the consensus and the analysis of what's wrong with Suarez?
I think there's a strong feeling he's not physically fit. You might remember he started the season, he missed the first couple of games. He got injured in the Super Cup against Real Madrid. And he missed a game or two at the most. And then he went on international duty because there were important World Cup qualifiers. And he rushed back to play for Uruguay in those. And he didn't really stop after that. And I think that there's a feeling he's not fit. You often see him, he's limping, he's not moving freely. And Kevin, you know, if you're not fully fit, then it does affect your performance and you lose your confidence. So I think everyone's hoping it's that, because if it's not, then it could be a longer term decline. You know, he's in his 30s now and looking way short of the player that he used to be. It doesn't help that he doesn't have the support. You know, the threesome that he's played with the last couple of years, Messi, Neymar, Suarez all together. Now it's him on his own up front and Messi playing in more the traditional playmaker role. So he is often isolated, which he obviously can't do anything about. But yeah, his form is a real worry.
Mm. The short answer to this question may be we don't know. But do we know, or has there been any inkling, if Messi, as part of his negotiations, has looked for concrete assurances about Barcelona spending over the next season or two, given the worries over Suarez? Iniesta is not exactly a young man at this stage, in plain terms, and you're looking around thinking, you know, where is this all going, really? Am I going to be carrying this, by comparison with the Golden Era, this very average team on my back? Yeah. It's not like he overly respects the Barcelona board either.
Yeah, and that was notable a few weeks ago. The president, Josep Maria Bartomeu, had a challenge, a formal challenge from someone who wanted to try and oust him, and he had to collect a certain number of signatures, and it was a big story over here. And Messi at that time said nothing. He could have very easily, just a one-liner, support his president, but he said nothing. And there was a lot of talk that he wanted the president out. Did he seek assurances? Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, that's always been a suspicion with Messi, certainly in the last few years, that he's, some people rather unkindly nickname him the little dictator, that everything has to be to his liking. He plays where he wants in the team. They hire the coaches that he wants. They make the signings he wants. I'm not sure that's entirely true, to be honest. I'm sure that it's been discussed. And his father, Jorge, who manages his affairs and negotiated his contract, I'm sure there was a lot of discussion. What are the plans for this team? Where are we going with this team? Mm. But at the same time, you know, we're painting a negative picture here for a team that's top of the league, unbeaten. I think the crucial statistic for Barcelona is they've only conceded 5 goals all season. Yesterday, Valencia only had 1 shot on target, despite having scored nearly 3 per game beforehand. So they are looking very solid now, much more solid as a team, much more balanced, much more of a collective unit as a team. They're working well together. What they're lacking is that little bit of variety up front. And coming back to Dembélé, you know, 150 million, I think, is the second most expensive player ever. He better be good. And if he's as good as they think he's going to be, obviously that's a huge addition to the squad. Yeah. And it could make all the difference to giving Suarez more support, giving defenders someone else to worry about to create more space to Messi. So it's going to be really interesting to see how Dembélé gets on when he comes back in 2 or 3 weeks, probably.
I think the other big talking point over there in Spain at the moment, Andy, certainly around Real Madrid, and you mentioned there Valencia, Atletico had a big win at the weekend, but certainly Real, Joe and I were just talking off air before, and under most circumstances, you'd be looking at a Real Madrid manager under pressure, but because it's Zinedine Zidane, because he's won the 2 Champions League, it seems less likely. But what is the situation there? Did they scrape to another win at the weekend, Ronaldo scoring the winner after missing the penalty with the follow-up he scored? So what is the story then around Real Madrid at the moment? Is it doom and gloom, or are they just waiting? Because I saw Zidane talking today about the return of Gareth Bale as well, that he's got Benzema, Bale and Ronaldo back in the side, that he's hopeful of better things to come.
Yeah, well, without wishing to be unkind to Bale, though, no one expects him to stay fit for long.
Yeah.
He hasn't for the last year and a half. Every time he comes back, 3 or 4 weeks later, he's out again. And I think people now are starting to talk more about the transfer market. And the big, the name that's been repeated over and over again since the summer is Alvaro Morata. Why did they let him go when they didn't sign someone? And I think the answer is they thought they were going to get Mbappe, and then he surprised them by going to PSG instead. But they really need, especially given the injury problems that Bale has, and you have to unfortunately think that's probably going to continue. Given the fact that Ronaldo needs to be rested fairly regularly now, they desperately need another striker. And now you're sure Zidane would be wishing that they hadn't let Morata go, knowing now that they weren't able to get Mbappe. So I think everyone's looking towards January and going to see what are they going to do in the transfer market. But you're also right, there's not much pressure on Zidane yet. There's widespread recognition that Madrid aren't playing well. They haven't been playing well all season. But he's got so much credit for the trophies he's won and how well he got them to play towards the end of last season. And just the general respect that he has. You know, his manner demands respect, not just what he achieved as a player, but the way he conducts himself to everyone, the media, everyone respects him. The fans respect him. The players, you can tell, love him. So he's not in trouble yet. But January could be interesting to see who they go for. If they go for a big name, they need someone proven, I think, who could just come in and give an alternative to Benzema and Ronaldo to get you some goals.
How likely would that Icardi deal from Inter Milan, is that a likely deal to happen, the one I've been reading about over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, well, he's in demand. There's a lot of talk about him and Barcelona. Well, as long term, we were talking about Luis Suarez earlier, and Barca will need a replacement for Suarez at some point soon, and Icardi's been linked to there as well. It's just January. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's so difficult to do deals in January. As you know, not many big deals happen. And if Real Madrid are going to sign a striker, it's going to be a big deal. You're looking at a 100 million deal probably. And it's so rare for things of that nature to happen in January.
Andy, brilliant. Thanks a million.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Cheers. Andy West there, who's the BBC's Spanish football correspondent. Short break.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. With live AIB club football and hurling action this month on AIR Sport.
This is News Talk.
Welcome back. It will be interesting to see how it all works out in Spain. I suppose if it's the case that Suarez isn't fit, as opposed to, as you might presume from a distance, maybe he's just hit a certain age and it's a terminal issue, he may well get fit over the Christmas break. He may well come back flying, and then Dembélé comes into the side and he's got pace, and you've got Dembélé and Suarez and Messi feeling good about life and they're good defensively. We could well be sitting here in May as they go for a Champions League saying, well,
yeah,
all is fine there. And then Florentino Perez, the Madrid president, obviously visited the dressing room at full time yesterday after Madrid had scored the winner, and according to one of the local Spanish newspapers, did congratulate the team, but was not without complaint. So doesn't think they're doing all that much at the moment. And apparently he was disappointed that Zidane took off Isco. You're kind of thinking,
I know.
Is Zidane going to listen to this from...
I know.
You know, why didn't you take off Isco?
They apparently got a good relationship as well,
I know,
haven't
but
they?
You must think Zidane's thinking to himself, I can't believe I have to sit here and explain this to you.
Yeah.
Was two Champions League
sure,
not enough?
I'm sure, though, as soon as Zinedine Zidane speaks to him and starts to... And he'd be like, oh, yeah, you're right, yes, you are. I can imagine that'd be the sort of conversation that would have been had there.
Yeah. So Ronaldo scored. They are, though, they dropped into fourth spot because Atletico... beat Levante 5-0, so they're behind Atletico on goal difference. They're in fourth. Real Madrid. The Gareth Bale thing just seems like it's not going to work out.
It does. I was looking at his record today. I think it's 75 goals. Was it 149? He's got basically just under a 1-2 record anyway.
Yeah.
Amazing goal scoring. Amazing time that he's had there. But it's that fitness issue that Andy spoke about there when he hasn't been able to get himself right.
Yeah.
Is he going to come back to the Premier League? Would he be able to stay fit if he came back to the Premier League? That'd be the thing, wouldn't it?
His agent, Jonathan Barnett, came out
yesterday
and said he's not leaving.
Yeah.
100% not leaving. So he said he wants to finish his career there, but, you know.
How old is he now, Bale? 27, 28, I think it'll be.
So earlier on, we asked you which side did Brandon Driscoll make his international debut against back in 1999. The answer is Australia. So congratulations to Ed Connolly, to Fergal Martin, to Barry Coogan, and to Karen Talbot. You each win a pair of tickets to come along to the latest Off the Ball Roadshow with thanks to HeinekenRugbyClub.com. It's on next Thursday. We're at the Stella Theatre in Rathmines, and Warren Gatland will be the guest there, so it should be really good. Warren Gatland there alongside Jer and Brian O'Driscoll and Keith Wood. And if you missed out tonight, we'll give you another chance to win tomorrow. So tomorrow morning, Shane Stapleton is with Jer for OTB AM. They'll be talking to 17-year-old superstar swimmer Mona McSharry. She won a gold medal at the Junior World Championships in the US during the summer. We don't produce many swimmers who do that. So the show, as ever, is live from 7:45 a.m. on Facebook tomorrow. Periscope, youtube.com/offtheball. Tomorrow night we have got Aidan O'Shea on the
there
show.
There we go.
Finally, says Caban. Finally. We've got Andy Lee, who's in the studio. He's Eric Donovan's fighting this weekend. Remember we spoke to Eric Donovan?
Yeah. Saw that. I saw him tweeting the other day. So
Andy Lee has been coaching him. So we said, hang on here. Come in here. Talk to us about coaching. He's been coached by the greats from Emmanuel Stewart through. So we'll talk to Andy about what it's like coaching on the side.
Yeah.
Eric Donovan's going to be on OTB AM
on
Wednesday.
I'd say be a good coach, Andy. I'd say be able to get his ways. His mannerisms are great around people, but I think getting his trying to get his thoughts across to a fighter, I think he'd be spot on with that.
Well, I think we'll have a nice conversation about the art of boxing coaching.
Yeah.
It'll be nice tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that's a good show tomorrow. And if you missed anything tonight, it's all available for podcast, offtheball.com, iTunes, or wherever you get your stuff. Tom Dunn is on the way, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Give him a ball and he out of grass. He'll give you a move for the perfect pass. Give him a ball and he out of space. He'll give you a move with guilt like your eyes. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ta.